Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Roadmap, an old school gaming podcast where we explore how the games of the past brought us the games we love today. I'm your host Grant, and today we're discussing Sam & Max Hit the Road. Released in 1993, this game came out during the height of the adventure game era. The developer, LucasArts, was known for a combination of their great adventure games and their stable of Star Wars titles that they had at their command. Bit of a warning for this episode, as with all episodes, just assume it's filled with spoilers from here on out. So let's jump right on into it. This game at its core is a point-and-click adventure, so you're using your walk icons, your use icons, pick-up icons. You're interacting with different parts of the screen, different parts of the environment, having conversations with different characters to unlock new information, unlock puzzles, unlock locations, and using all that information to solve the ultimate story of the game. The core mechanics here, it takes place over all of America. It's a bit of a road trip concept game, so you're constantly unlocking new locations, mostly with items, sometimes through conversations, but it is predominantly items that you find throughout the course of the game. One of the big elements of it, of course, is you combine items to make new items, and you use items on the screen to solve different puzzles. A prime example of that is going to be one of the more esoteric puzzles you get is you find a ball grabber at a Gator golf course. You find the hand of Jesse James in a jar at a carnival, and you find a fish magnet in the lost and found section of the carnival. And you have to open up the jar by going to a roadside convenience store. You have to attach that to the ball grabber, and then you have to attach the fish magnet to that, all to get a ring out of a giant ball of twine. Now, the dialogue system in this game really did open up a new style. They went with icon-based dialogue instead of showing you exactly what you were going to say on the screen. Part of the logic behind this from the developers was that because this relies so heavily on humor, their take was that nothing would kill a joke worse than reading it before you hear it. Basically, the concept being that if you only have a rough idea what you're going to ask about, say, asking about a Bigfoot or asking about this jar that you have on you, you don't know what joke they're going to make, and it allows you to enjoy the experience as you're going along. The graphics for this game are very much in the style of a hand-drawn animation, very classic cartoon style, given the nature of the characters. It is pixel-based work. You can see every now and then the pixely nature of it, but it is definitely based off of hand-drawn artwork. So they would draw it by hand and then take that, convert it into a pixel art, clean it up a little bit in the computer, and then put the basic colors on there because it didn't have a deep, deep color option at the time. Now, I'm going to give you a rundown on the story of this game. It starts with a cold open, giving you a sense of who the characters are. Basically, you have a girl on a date with a mad scientist. Turns out it's not going that well. She just wants to be friends. And that, in turn, has her put into his death machine. Sam and Max bust in, rescue the girl, well, save the day, leave the girl tied up on the corner. As they drive off, we go into our opening credit scene, which is an amazing bit of music that I still love and I still catch myself humming all the time. Then we go to their office where they get a call from the commissioner, who you never see but hear from. He gives you a case where he needs you to go to a carnival and find out that Bruno the Bigfoot and Trixie the giraffe neck girl have gone missing. This lets you solve a small puzzle to find your actual orders from the commissioner. And when you get to the carnival, it lets you explore the whole carnival, play some of the games, ride the rides. One of the rides, you end up losing your stuff. And when you get a ticket to go to the Lost and Found, you end up getting a clue, and this is how you learn about different locations opening up throughout the course of the game. First couple locations you open up is the World of Fish, and that is just a giant fishing site where you can get a bucket of fish, you can talk to a guy that's very much like Woody Allen, get into a giant fish at one point. From the World of Fish, you learn about the world's largest ball of twine, and from another location at the carnival, you actually learn about the Gator Golf location. All of these are very kitschy, very classic Americana road trip cliche stuff that people from outside the States would recognize as road trip locations. Another location you open up is the Mystery Vortex, where everything just disobeys the laws of physics, but it's all controlled by magnets deep within the Earth's crust. Not a lie. A joke in the game, but not a lie. One of the gags you get at the largest ball of twine up in the top, one that I really enjoy because it takes advantage of the visual and audio nature of it. They use comic book censoring with the swear words of one of the characters, followed by Sam and Max making reference to the different characters, actually like ampersand, percent, sign, dollar sign. And when they ask what they're doing, they just say they're swearing in longhand. And to me, that just sums up the humor of all this. Eventually, your exploring leads you to a place called Frog Rock. That is just a rock on the ground. There's nothing that looks like a frog. You got to assume there's some story behind it where, at one point, about 50 frogs piled up on that rock, so they called it Frog Rock. That leads you to Bumpusville, which takes you to the main villain of the game's lair, and that's where you find Bruno and Trixie. You free them from their capture. And that leads you in kind of the very tail end of the game, where you get to the Savage Jungle Inn, where the Bigfoot convention is going on. Because it turns out a bunch of Bigfoots have gone missing, and you find them all in one place having a convention slash reunion for their union, for their group. That actually ends up unlocking the final two locations that you find in the course of the game, Mount Rushmore Tar Pit slash Bungee Jumping location, and the Celebrity Vegetable Museum. All these locations come into play late in the game, more or less. You need to find four different items to represent the totems that the Bigfoot have found. And when you solve the whole puzzles for the game, you end up covering the entire western coast with a massive amount of trees. It's a pretty weird way to take it from a find the lost character to all of a sudden you're saving an entire race of mythical creatures concept throughout the game, but it doesn't seem like it should flow, and yet somehow it does, just because it's the nature of the characters. Now, if I were to list all the characters throughout this game, it would take way too long. Everybody has a very defined personality, very clear image of who they are, so I'm just going to hit on the kind of the core group. You have Sam, the giant dog wearing a suit. He's very much a Bogart-style detective, straight out of the film noir style. Little bit of Dragnet filtered in there just for a little bit of style. His partner, Max, who is a hyperactive, violent rabbit thing, is just that. He is a hyper-violent character. It plays well because it's very cartoony, but he is very much he is the one you use for violence. You can actually use him as an item to make things happen at times, usually involving dismemberment, assault, what have you. The villain of the game, the closest thing this game is going to have to a core key villain, because you don't run across him too often, he just kind of pops up briefly, is Conroy Bumpus. He is a very diminutive, British-based country and western singer from Liverpool, and he has very much that Liverpool accent, so it's the Beatles meet Elvis in terms of concept. And has a sidekick called Lee Harvey, who basically does all the muscle work for him, beats up people, what have you. The first Bigfoot you are told about is named Bruno. He becomes kind of the main MacGuffin for the majority of the game, him and his girlfriend Trixie, the giraffe neck girl who's in love with him from reading to him every night. There's a lot of other Bigfoots throughout. Pretty much every major location you go to has a Bigfoot referenced, because they were all using them frozen as tourist attractions. The other thing that pops up is there's a couple mole men in the game, and they're very much shut-in hippies. They help you out with a few key items, they point you in a few key directions, but for the most part, they are just straight-up hippies. But they are, for the most part, just there to kind of point you in the next direction, get you onto the next step in the game. The voice acting for this game is really fun. It has a very diverse, very broad cast. The key ones to look out for are, of course, Sam and Max. Bill Farmer did the voice of Sam. Most people are going to know him as Goofy. He's been Goofy since the late 80s, so if you're from my generation, maybe slightly younger, you saw a Goofy movie. It's him. He's done a lot of the Goofy stuff. Having him play the film noir character is just an absolute joy. It's a blast. They never thought they were going to get him for this game, and were just tickled that he ended up doing it all. Max is performed by a man named Nick Jameson. Best way to look at what else he's done is he did Dr. Fred and all the Fred equivalents in the Day of the Tentacle game. Another great LucasArts game I would highly recommend playing. And he did various voices all over different games. Like if you've played games, if you've seen shows, you've heard him at some point. As I said, there's too many people to mention in this game overall. I just wanted to focus on those two, but there are a lot of fun impressions out there. There's a Woody Allen, there's a Jimmy Stewart. Not 100% Rich Little style impressions, but very clear who they're trying to reference in the course of it. The soundtrack for this game, I cannot recommend enough. It has a smooth jazz sound to it. The opening credit song exemplifies it. I'm going to throw a link in the show notes, a link on the website, maybe do a little article showing some of the elements of the game, some of the songs of the games, because this just nails it. It sets the tone right from the get-go. It flows right throughout the game. You never once feel like you want to mute the music and put something else on over the course of it. Now, there's a bit of fun trivia of this game. The lead designer of it, the creator of the character, Steve Purcell, he had been working for LucasArts for a while, and he slipped these characters into a few games just for fun, kind of Easter eggs in other games out there. But the other thing is he also included them in the LucasArts newsletter, their internal newsletter that went around in the company. Got a little bit more attention that way. He was able to create his own comic book at that point, sell it as a bit of an indie title, and that became the basis for this game. It got the game greenlit, and they took one of the adventures, which was the road trip around America, and turned that into its own game story. During the development, this was in the early 90s, when games were starting to get a little bit more attention in the press as sources of violence, sources of mature content that wasn't necessarily known for something that should belong in a quote-unquote kid's hobby. So during the development, Purcell was very worried that the more adult tone, the more adult violence and humor of it all would be forced to be toned down. He wasn't going to be allowed to keep it in. And was very surprised when they really didn't stop him from putting anything in at all, trusting that the audience was going to be found. One of the fun bonuses of this game is if you got the CD version of it, the CD-ROM version of the game, the music for it, the soundtrack for it, were basically just WAV files on the disc so they would run as their own tracks. And this was called a mixed mode CD. This was a very, I wouldn't say very common, but semi-common thing at the time, where the very first track would be the game data or the program data. Everything else would be their own tracks of music. So you could pop it into a CD player at home, in your car, and just skip over the first track, and all of a sudden you have the full soundtrack of the game available to you at the cost of purchasing the game itself, almost as a nice little bonus. Now, there were a few attempts at doing sequels to this game. They'd looked at doing it a couple times. The last of the times they did it, it got canceled back in 2002, and it was going to be almost a 3D upgrade to it, like they had done with Grim Fandango. They were looking at doing with the Monkey Island franchise at the same time, but it ended up getting canceled, and it really didn't get off the ground again until, as we talked about in the previous episode, Telltale Games came around. Now, Telltale was able to resurrect this franchise. They brought it back for three different seasons of their timeline. Early Telltale got their start on Bone, which was another independent comic book based game, and Sam and Max. The team at Telltale was actually made up of a lot of old LucasArts staff. Much of the team had been working on the Sam and Max games over the years, and they came back for this. They brought back Steve Purcell for this as well to get him involved in the development. What they did is they bought their license back from LucasArts. They basically said, look, you guys aren't doing anything with this. Here's money that we've raised. Let us do it because we know there's a market for it. And they did. They brought it back, and instead of doing what Telltale's become known now, which is story-based, choice-based games, they were true to the original style. They made it puzzle games. They inventory puzzles, dialogue puzzles. Each episode, you had a story to solve, and they would tie into an overarching episode for the whole season. And like I said, there were three seasons, which was three extra games that we got that after how many years in limbo, which was just such a blast to see. So now, of course, we come to my favorite section of any episode of any game we cover, and that is the manual. This game, the version I had growing up, it came with both a manual and a hint book in case you got stuck in the course of the game. And what you had was the manual, which was looking at the different areas that you could go to, and it had little images in the corner of different costumes that Sam and Max were wearing. That was the copy protection at the time. If it decided to trigger copy protection, you would have to go to the manual, open up the page it requested, and actually dress up Sam and Max accordingly. God help you if you missed a accessory that you didn't notice at the time, because it would punish you for it. The hint book is where it gets really, really interesting, because it gives you three basic setups. It gives you the question, you know, I'm stuck at this point, what am I supposed to do? Then it'll give you a little hint, a slightly bigger hint, and then a very blatantly obvious hint. But for flavor, the back end of the hint book, the last, I'd almost say a third of it, is filled up with a full write-up of the game as if it's an old detective story. Very much in the Raymond Chandler style story, where it's just a full write-up on it. You know, each section has its own chapter heading. It goes through it. It tells you everything that was happening over the course of the game. It's, if you read it beforehand, it basically gives you all the hints you're going to need on its own. Or if you go back and read it afterwards, it's kind of a fun rehash of everything you've gone through in the course of the game. It's just, it is a joy. Now, if you want to play this game yourself, you can actually get it at GOG.com. They were the ones who really brought it back. It uses the Scum VM engine, which is a fan-made engine to run the old LucasArts games on modern systems. It's $5.99 US. They're not a sponsor of the show. I just really do believe in what the site does. I think they've done great work, and they've put a lot of the legwork into getting all these old games back, so I'm happy to encourage you to get from them. Also, that's going to include the manual in most of the big languages that you're going to need, and the hint book for the game. Again, if you're ever thinking about buying this, this is the way to go play it. It's a lot easier to run. It saves you a lot of the legwork and hassle that you're going to need to worry about. Now, in terms of who I would recommend this game for, I would absolutely encourage it to be used for anybody that loves good old point-and-click adventure games. If you have a bit of an off sense of humor, this game is very much for you, even if you're not a big adventure player. And anybody that likes good detective stories and just enjoys a little bit of a mystery when they're playing. If you're going to play this, I would definitely recommend having the hint guide with you, though, only because some of the puzzles are very esoteric, very out there. The trope name for it is moon logic, but there's just some puzzles you're not going to be able to solve unless you have a bit of a help out. Even at the time, it was a little bit tricky to carry on the logic you needed to solve the puzzle back in the day. So that's it for Sam and Max Hit the Road. Thanks for joining us this month, and if you want to reach out to us, you can. If you want to do so on Twitter, at Roadmap Podcast, or on the website, roadmappodcast.com, feel free to suggest some older games we should play, maybe share some of your favorite memories, or even ask a question. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us a review. It's the only way we'll get better. Next month, we're going to be playing the original Command & Conquer from Westwood Studios. In the meantime, check back in 2 weeks. We're going to be doing a more in-depth look at the real-time strategy genre as a primer for Command & Conquer, and really look at how it started, how it grew, how StarCraft became the focus it is in the esports scene, and how real-time strategies helped spawn the MOBA genre that has become such a juggernaut today. Thanks for listening.